back to another Your Ball Was Out podcast with Philip from Tweener Head Tennis. Today we have the famous John Parsons, our college tennis insider, back on the pod to talk about this upcoming season, what it meant to have individuals in the fall, and what teams we need to look out for, as well as players that are going to make the biggest impact in the 2025 season. I hope you guys do enjoy this episode with John. Make sure you guys are following us on all social media platforms. Make sure you are subscribed to us on the Tweener Head Tennis YouTube channel, so that way you don't miss the video interviews as well. But without further ado, here is our latest podcast with John Parsons from No Ad, No Problem. John, another season, another day in college tennis. But for all those that don't know John, I don't know how you don't know him. He is one of the original college tennis providers in terms of information and anything within that realm. And John's one of our very, I would say, frequent. You're a returning guest a lot here. So I do appreciate you taking time out of your day to come and talk to us. But John, welcome back. And you ready to talk some college tennis?
Well, thank you for having me back, and I will never decline an invite to talk about college tennis. So that's why you see me so often here. If you're going to invite me, I'm going to come.
Fantastic. And to start off, I think the biggest thing we have to start with is the individuals this past fall being held. And I, from what I've heard and from what I've talked to, what I've talked about with other people that have been on this channel, with Nate from Not Your Country Club, other coaches, about the fall individual changeup, it doesn't seem like it's a very, as of right now, it doesn't seem like a very popular decision amongst coaches and media, for that matter.
I think it's very mixed. I think being on the grounds in Waco in November, this is the first year they've ever held the individual championships in the fall. Mm-hmm. There are some players that I think really like it, having a solidified season. And certainly that might be biased because I was talking to players on site in Waco who made it. The reasons why coaches don't like it is because it does rob them of some development time. Let's say you bring in a new freshman and you want to work with them for an extended period of time. You don't really have any time for that because you have to start playing these events, gearing up for NCAAs. You're always on the road in the fall. You're working towards this goal. It disrupts sort of what development time they might be able to have. On the media side, I think one of the value props of doing this was that we could fill a space in a very busy, crammed ATP WTA calendar. Like, where are these pockets where college tennis might get some love? Mm-hmm. So that still holds true. Like, it is a less busy time during the professional tennis calendar. Now, whether or not we make good on that value prop and start to see linear networks like ESPN or Tennis Channel start to cover it remains to be seen. That didn't happen this past fall. So I think it's still a mixed bag. I think ultimately, if this is able to further ingrain tennis in an athletic administration viewpoint, that's great. If it just ends up being a thorn in the side and more costs for college tennis, then that's not a great thing.
I like the way you put it too, when you talk about filling the void, at least in terms of content creation. At least for me, that's how I view it when it comes to when you have that big, I would say, September through December of who are we covering? Who are we watching? What tournaments are happening? And by that point, after the US Open, I think the biggest issue that people had after the US Open, a lot of people would just stop watching tennis because that's kind of like the end all be all of the tennis season for a lot of people that follow tennis. So I agree with you. It does fill a void that can be exploited to promote college tennis. But the problem is whether or not we're taking advantage of that opportunity is a different one. And through ESPN and through Tennis Channel, Gruskin and Cracked Rackets have been doing such a great job, as well as yourself and so many others that have been promoting this sport and what these guys are going through. But if we go into that developmental side to dig into that more, a lot of the top individuals did not participate in the individual side, at least for the men. We didn't see a lot of them that could have made a bigger impact of the tournament than who participated. Michael Zhang from Colombia obviously won it, but there were a couple people that were absent that really could have given him a run for his money or could have changed the outlook of the draw.
Yeah, I think we need more data on this. We need to see how this continues. I do think generally we are seeing more of a trend, particularly on the men's side. More men are taking the fall off and then playing in the spring. They're trying to take advantage of the amount of North American challengers that exist in that September through November timeframe. So you saw players this past season, like a Jack Pennington Jones of TCU, like a Murphy Cassone of Arizona State, not play this event. Now we need to see how it develops because we are also on the heels of in the spring, we had number one seed Johannes Munde of Tennessee not play due to injury. We had Chris Rodesh of Virginia, a top five seed, not play because of illness. And so there are typically top people missing from this individual event for one reason or another. So it's tough to know if this is going to continue to get worse and more players are going to skip the fall, or if this is at kind of on par with what we should expect, where you have a handful of top players missing every year.
And going along that line too, I agree. There's a lot of people that there's always going to be people missing because of illness or whatever they're going through. But for something like the ATP Accelerator Program for college players that have an opportunity to play fall events but are still kind of split between participating with their team during these events or going to play a challenger that they can automatically qualify for with this accelerator program, it's a hard divide because you either one, go with your team, or two, pursue your pro tennis, which has in the past been known to be a way to work on your game and play these events to see how you would do on that next level. So I feel like that balance, it should, it's not just for the summer, but that off season where they get to train as a professional athlete, not just in school, but outside of it during the fall, is really key for that accelerator program to launch these players to the next level.
Yeah, there's a lot of irony, right, in earning your 6 to 8 ATP accelerator spots and then not being able to use them because you are playing college events in the fall and not being able to go and use them at these really valuable North American challengers. And I think for those players that want to make the leap to pro tennis, I always think back to a conversation I had with former Duke player Garrett Johns, who took the fall off in his 5th year. And he said one of the biggest benefits of doing that was not just exposing to the level of play, but from June through December, he was a full-time pro tennis player. He had to book his travel by himself. He had to rent cars by himself. He had to do lodging and food and everything that comes with traveling internationally and playing pro tournaments that you don't have the luxury of having, in his case, Duke do all of that for you. And that extended period of time is a big learning curve that they can go through so that when they do make that jump, they're far more equipped to do it instead of only having maybe an abbreviated June to August, where it's basically a summer camp version of it instead of having like an elongated summer and fall.
No, I agree. And it does give a different perspective and outlook into how they approach the game and how they mentally have to prepare themselves for what the grind is going to be from literally the ground up if they aren't being scheduled for them. And you mentioned Jack Pennington Jones, and that's actually a really good segue for the next because there's a lot of this season, at least, there's a lot of names that are coming to college tennis or coming back to college tennis, I should say, that are going to make a huge impact this season, at least in my opinion. And to give the three names that I gave John before we started was Liv Hovde. I have to make sure I'm pronouncing that right.
Yeah, I think it's Hovde.
Hovde, thank you. Liv Hovde from who just committed to Duke, who won the Junior Wimbledon Championships in singles. What was it, 2 years ago? 22?
Well, yeah, 2.5 years ago. Yeah, 22.
22. Oh yeah, we're in 2025. Yikes.
Yeah. Yeah, she won it when she was 16, so it was a little bit ago.
Yeah, it was. Alexa Noel, who dropped off, no offense to her, dropped off the face of the planet in terms of pro tournaments until she just announced she's coming back. And then the man you mentioned, Jack Pennington Jones, who was voted the most outstanding player in the NCAA tournament when they won the national title. So out of these three, and maybe a couple more that I'm not recalling off the top of my head, which one of these three do you think will have a bigger impact for their school?
Well, I mean, that's really tough because they're all so different. We've seen Jack Payton Jones and Alexa Noel are one is NCAA most outstanding player in the team competition. The other is an NCAA singles champion. I would say Alexa Noel is probably not going to have that big of an impact for Miami just because maybe they go from making the second round to reaching a Sweet 16, but it doesn't vault them to be a national title contender, let's say. Whereas when JPJ comes back, that immediately puts TCU in that top tier of teams that are competing for an NCAA title. It makes their ability, TCU's ability here, to go back to back very real. But I would say the Hovde addition brings Duke to be a top tier team. They bring back a lot of experience of players that have gone through ups and downs at Duke. Duke is your traditional blue blood program in women's tennis, but had back-to-back second round losses over the past few years. They now bring her in at the top of that lineup. It moves everyone else down. They're going to be a very real threat to make it very deep in NCAAs.
Is there any other names that I'm forgetting? Because yes, there's a lot of names that are coming into college tennis, and even some newer ones too that are coming into the spring semester that weren't there in the fall that could make an impact at some of these schools. Is there any names that I might be forgetting or ones that we should be on the lookout for the 20, I should say 2025 year?
There are so many January admits this season, and that's one of the reasons why the individuals in the fall might not make a ton of sense. Because I would venture to guess when we look at the rankings, sort of the best players in college tennis come May, a lot of them were going to be January admits. Now, a lot of them are freshmen, but one January admit that we're going to be seeing back in college tennis is Stefan Dostanich. He's formerly the top player in the country with USC. He is transferring for his sixth year to Wake Forest. And so,
Wild.
very similar to Jack Pennington Jones, that bumps Wake Forest up into that upper echelon of teams. Now, they did make the NCAA Final Four this past year, but that is a huge addition that you can look to this season.
And he going to literally a top five school in Wake Forest, currently sitting at number four in the preseason rankings, to my knowledge. It's you see all these guys that are coming in and making such a big impact immediately that really not only transcends their team, but the conference as well. Like the ACC this year, I think, is going to be a totally different conference than last year.
Well, it helps the fact that they get Stanford, Cal, and SMU into that conference. So it is a
Yes.
much bigger conference than last year. Stanford being one of the winningest programs in men's tennis. We haven't seen them at the top in quite some time, but still a very deep team. Cal, we saw make huge inroads this past season. They actually had the most men's singles players in the NCAA singles tournament. So they're going to be deep as well. But yeah, you have Wake, you have Virginia, who has been good for a decade and a half now. NC State has a lot of veterans returning to that team. So it's going to be a very deep ACC conference. And Dostanich partnering with DK Suresh at the top of that Wake lineup is as good a 1-2 punch as you're going to find.
I agree. And even with the SEC realignment too, it's gonna be I'm excited for that. It's always gonna be a fun one. And can you remind me if Jack Kennedy's coming in this spring or next
Yeah,
year?
he's next year to
He's next
UVA,
year.
but that brings up another name. We talk about January admits, Rafar Hodar, the US Open boys junior champion from last fall, is joining Virginia in January. He's on campus now. So there are a lot of January admits who have entered the collegiate ranks just in the past few weeks.
That's unreal. And for that, speaking of Wake Forest being in the top five, number four, right now there seems to be a consensus going around in college tennis, at least from what you've talked about and from what I've heard on Cracked Rackets and from Gruskin, it's when you have Ohio State, Texas, and TCU at the top of that three, and you look at everyone else, do people come in, is 4 through 25 looking at that like that's those three are going to be the toughest ones to beat this year, or is it just them three being the favorites the whole season, or can we expect someone else to kind of enter that conversation as a powerhouse?
I mean, I made this mistake last season when I sort of had two tiers. I had Texas and Virginia at the top tier, and then I had TCU, Ohio State, and Stanford as that next tier. Obviously, TCU goes on to win the title, so I feel a little burned by stating that there's like a tier above. But if I were to really split hairs, I would say it's T Texas and TCU on a tier. They're your defending NCAA finalists. And then I would put Ohio State joining Wake Forest there in that next tier. And to me, the debate is around number five. I think there are probably 10 to 12 teams you could make an argument for that should be the number five team.
And I hate to put you on the spot like this, but when you look at teams like that, who would you say, if you were to go through, not so, it's so early to predict, but end of the year, top five, who would you pick?
So it's a great question. I had this debate recently with Ethan on my podcast. It's tough because I think there are a few names that come to mind. One is Columbia. I think they have the NCAA singles champion. They don't lose a lot from a team that made their first quarterfinal last season. I think they are on the short list. Now, whether or not they can get enough ranked wins over the course of the season, being in the Ivy League to be number five is a question. Michigan State, I think it's going to be very strong this season. They have Ozan Berish, NCAA singles finalist. From a UTR perspective, they're a top five team. Now, what is good about Michigan State this year is they were probably underranked last year because they didn't have the schedule to get the ranked wins, and the Big Ten was in a down year. Now, head coach Harry Jayden knows he has a good team. He's scheduled aggressively, and the Big Ten is going to be good this year. They're going to get the additions of UCLA and USC. So Michigan State's another team that you would circle as potentially making a huge jump into that top 10. I would say Columbia is the like
Is the favorite.
smart is the smart pick. Michigan State's the spicy one.
How? Talk to me about San Diego.
San Diego had a great fall. Oliver Tarvett was the All-American singles champion, and he won the doubles title there. Had a disappointing NCAA singles tournament, lost in the first round there, got a brutal draw. The problem with San Diego, you think about, oh, who could be top five? They are not going to get as many ranked opponents being in the WCC. And when we talk about rankings in college tennis, it only matters who you beat and who you lost to. And if you're in a conference like the SEC, getting those ranked wins, particularly just wins over someone that's ranked 25 or 30, do a lot for your ranking. And San Diego could very well be in a position where they have maybe five really good wins and everyone feels like they're a top 10, top 16 team. But what about wins 6, 7, 8, 9? Like, if those are coming against opponents in the WCC that aren't ranked that high, it's going to be hard to get San Diego ranked too high. So I think they have an outside shot at top 10. Being a top 10 caliber team, are they going to be ranked top five? No way.
Well, it looks like I'm just looking at their schedule right now. They're playing Oklahoma State, they play SMU, they play Oklahoma, Arizona State, Southern California, even Middle Tennessee State, and then they get conference. So even before conference, it's honestly it's a decent like pre-conference schedule that they get to test themselves with. But how many of those would they have to get? How many wins out of let's just say the first five that I mentioned.
To be
OSU,
what, top five or top 10?
let's go top 10. out of all of those.
They have to, of the five, they'd have to go 4-1.
Okay. It really, but it just shows you the lack of not depth, but just how much the ranking system refers to your conference.
Yeah,
And
I mean, San Diego's best case situation is that they also qualify for indoors.
yeah.
But there's a really scary word in there for a San Diego team, and that's the word indoors. Because even if they qualify for indoors, they have to
Yeah.
go play indoors against the top teams in the country, which is,
Different.
different for that San Diego team. So it just becomes very hard when your schedule doesn't present you a lot of favorable opportunities to get those ranked wins.
Another schedule, not schedule, another rankings thing that I thought was interesting, and you pointed this out, but I wanted to hear more about it, was A&M being ranked 2 in the SEC preseason rankings, even though A&M just won the national championship. And while Georgia just had their individual NCAA's champion, why do you think A&M got put at 2 in the SEC?
Yeah, so this is on the women's side.
Women's side,
I think
excuse me.
there's,
Thank you.
there's a single name for that reason. That's Carson Brandstein. We saw what Texas A&M looked like without Carson Brandstein last season. Georgia beat up on that Texas A&M team without Carson Brandstein. She comes back into that lineup, moves everyone down from 3 through 6, and they were going to win that NCAA title running away with it. I mean, they were clearly the best team there at NCAAs. They have lost Carson Brandstein. She's no longer on that roster. They didn't bring in any name to replace her at 1 or 2. And so they've taken a step back. Now they have added freshman Lexington Reed, who should be a factor for them at the bottom of the lineup. But what Carson was able to do at 2 and in doubles was a huge add for Texas A&M. So without an additional piece, that's why you see, I think, the voters in this case favoring a Georgia team who doesn't lose a single piece from their NCAA finalist team.
And Mary Stoyana, to you, can she have the same? It's funny how she was number one in the country, but yet she didn't make a bigger impact than Carson. Does that say more about their game or them
Well, they
as
still
a,
have Mary, right? So
yeah.
the delta between last season and this season is they lose Carson.
Yeah.
And you could have reversed it, right? If Carson was there last season and Mary's the one that comes in for SECs and NCAAs, like it still would have the same impact. The
Yeah.
ability to bring in someone that you can play at 1 or 2 and move everyone else down is a huge benefit to any team. Mary didn't have the fall that you might have expected this past season, which is maybe kind of what you're getting at, but she is still one of the highest ranked WTA players we have in college tennis. She had results outside of the collegiate tournaments that were very impressive. So she's still going to be one of the best players in the country. And I look forward to matches with her versus Vidmanova, your NCAA
Yeah.
singles champion, because those are always really fun.
Are they? So, from what I'm hearing, and correct me if I'm wrong, do you think they can go back to back or no?
I think they can absolutely go back to back. I think this was the team that was knocking on the door for a few years, continuing
Yeah.
to build that program. And I think getting over that hurdle instills a significant amount of confidence in you and a team. And I think we're starting to see that with players on that roster. They're having a much better fall than we had seen from them in the past years. Darya Smetanikov is playing excellent tennis in her junior season after really struggling her sophomore year. So I think winning that title does a lot for a program. I would put them there in that top tier of title contenders because they still have an excellent team that's loaded with talent.
And A&M's doing something really great this year too with their not incentive program, but they're selling tickets now to be courtside. And from what I've seen, it's $149 for almost courtside seats for the home season for fans to watch the women play. And I think this is an unbelievable idea by Aggieland because raises money. It gives people the opportunity to be right into the action like they weren't before, but even better to have that kind of s selling point towards fans and to get more people involved. And I feel like more teams and programs need to do something like this.
Yeah, I would extrapolate it and just say at the end of the day, if you're not doing something to build richer connections between your program, your players, and the fans at your matches, you are doing your program and your players and your community a disservice. And that might look like selling certain seats like Texas A&M. That might look like post-match selfies and autographs with the team, or I attended a Stanford basketball game yesterday and they did a head coach Q&A after the game. Like, that's interesting. Like, if you're not doing things that are deepening the connection, college tennis is in a perilous spot right now. So, anything you can do to find and bring out more folks who feel a deeper connection to your program, the better suited your program will be. And so, it's a testament to the innovation the Aggies are thinking through. And I'm sure they might have other things that are not published like those tickets are, but and more programs need to be thinking of ways to deepen that connection.
Because the one thing that I'm thinking of is what Chris Young did at Oklahoma State. He actually had a concert during the NCAAs, which I thought was a great way to get fans involved and a great way to kind of push more public people who enjoy that country artist to come and enjoy an atmosphere like that. And it really shows what can be done. It just needs to be done consistently and more, and it has to be broadened to all these other places.
Yeah, and that was a great idea. And that country singer was an Oklahoma State alum. So there's like a deep connection there. Now, it's challenging. It's easy for us to sit here and say, like, throw up a bouncy house, bring free food, do things to get people out to your matches, have a concert. All those things cost money. And so you can start small, right? You can start small with things that don't cost money, but maybe just invest time, like post-match interview or post-match selfies and things like that. You could do a kids clinic, like hit and giggle type thing where kids can come out and hit with players for a little bit. There are a lot of ways to just get more people involved in your program. And oftentimes, the more people you have involved and the deeper of a connection they feel, the more likely they are to give you some money down the line. So the more things that people can be doing and programs can be doing, the better. The other challenge here is that there are a lot of coaches who don't have that mindset, right? They might be very much X's and O's. And you're seeing, I think, a coaching evolution throughout all of college athletics, where so many of these coaches who are now having to deal with NIL and transfer portal and just things that were not or outside of the field or the court, they might not be well suited for it. And I do think you have profiles of college tennis coaches, some that fit sort of your X's and O's. I'm great at tennis and strategy and on the court, and others that are bigger picture thinkers or better executors of those sorts of ideas. And that's hard to find in a single person.
It is. And if we kind of move towards that NIL perspective, it's for me, I talked to, by the time this video comes out, I did an interview with James McKee, who was the associate head coach at Tennessee Knoxville, but now works for UTR, and talking about NIL deals and how it's kind of taking over what's going on in not just college sports, but college tennis as well. Because from the tennis recruiting article about Liv joining Duke, she signed with a professional sports agency who did her college deal for her, which to me, why do you need one for college sports? The point of doing this for some is student athlete. And for me, if you're going to do that, that's great. But why do you need an agent to help you pick where you go to school? That's just how I see it. It's definitely an ever-changing source. And with even according to recent reports, VCU is going to start paying all their student athletes in the 2025-2026 season. So it's like, how is that going to affect? Because it's not going to affect tennis as much because there's a lot of international students, but it will affect the top Americans that are choosing that college route.
Well, yeah, and we have the House settlement and the implications of that starting next season, right?
Yeah.
Which does mean that there's revenue sharing with these athletes, and it is still up in the air for how schools want to decide to allocate that money. Most seem to be trying to do some sort of, hey, how much value are you bringing in? Then we'll share out with you. So maybe tennis isn't that involved. You're seeing a lot of those same players are represented by agents in negotiating these NIL deals. And in the same way that an agent in pro sports is shopping around their athlete for brand deals, that's what you see some of these agents shopping around their players for schools, right? Who can give them the best amount? I think agents right now in tennis, based on my reporting, is pretty rare. We don't see a lot of agents in tennis, but you're seeing it in college athletics, and it's definitely become commonplace. And getting paid has become commonplace for a lot of the top tennis athletes as well. We'd be silly to not think that that's happening.
Because the other name that we forgot to mention for Duke is Cooper Williams. That was one of the biggest transfers as well, and what they must have done to get him away from Harvard must have been incredible.
Yeah, I mean, you certainly hear it's six figures plus, right? And yeah, so I mean, it seems like but I will say, like, it's not just Cooper Williams, right?
It
Like, Cooper
isn't.
Williams is
That's
not the
just a case.
only
It's just a case.
person exactly. So that's happening at these big schools, you know, like Stefan Dostanich is getting money to go to Wake Forest. That's not a secret. It's not taboo, but that's happening now, and it's just a shift that's happened in college athletics over the past few years.
One worry that I do have, though, if schools are evaluating how much revenue sports are bringing in, tennis is definitely on the very lower side. It's known as a non-revenue sport. How many schools is it an actual threat that schools will start thinking, if you're not bringing in this much money, you don't have that many players, what if we just cut the entire program? I feel like that's a big worry for some people that are at some of these schools.
It's absolutely a worry. And I think that's the extreme, right? Where they cut. There's also a very realistic path where they remove scholarships and essentially sort of, you know, kneecap the sport and kind of turn it into a club sport. But if you look at what's going to happen in this upcoming year, schools that want to be competitive in football are going to be on the hook for a little over $20 million to pay out to their athletes. Most of these athletic departments, pretty much all but literally a handful, operate in the red when it comes to their athletic budget. So finding an additional $20 million is going to be very hard to do. And there are going to be places that they'll have to make those cuts. And you're already hearing about non-public reports of schools, tennis in particular, that are reducing scholarships now that we are moving to a roster limit in 2025. And so I do think you're going to continue to see that there will be no more uniformity across college tennis, where you can pretty much guarantee that sort of any top 50 program has the full amount of scholarships. It's going to be very school to school dependent.
And it's sad to hear, but it's the reality of the situation when it comes to that. And it just shows kind of a flawed, I wouldn't say a flawed system, but definitely one that needs to be reevaluated. And I feel like we've been saying this for years in terms of what tennis can be doing in terms of creating value for a school or a product that is being sold on television.
Yeah, and I think if you are an AD looking at your sports as almost like a portfolio of investment, right? To say, hey, I think there's going to be a world where we can't really have any non-revenue sports. You at least need to be kind of neutral, right? If your budget is 3 million bucks, you better be able to fund it yourself or bring in that sort of money. And there are becoming more and more sports where you have a line of sight to them becoming revenue sports. There are a lot of women's sports, whether it's women's basketball, women's volleyball, softball, gymnastics, that are doing significantly better in terms of crowd attendance and TV deals that compared to tennis. And so if I'm an AD, those are sports where I'd be more willing to invest because I see a pathway to at least making more revenue there. That was not the case 15, 20 years ago when tennis was a much bigger slice of the pie.
I don't know if you will give me a straight answer on this, but what's the most frustrating thing about this for you?
That we didn't do more stuff sooner,
Okay.
right? I think that has to be it. But, it's very easy to be Monday morning quarterback, and hindsight is 2020. And I'm a bystander in a lot of this, right?
Yeah.
But there was a world 15 years ago where the NCAA individual finals were on an ESPN linear network, like ESPNU or ESPN2. Like that did exist, right? We've regressed from that while other sports have continued to move in that direction. So that's probably the frustrating thing is like I'm so excited by the growth across college sports, but it's painful not to see that really hit tennis.
And it feels like it keeps getting further away while we're still getting closer. It's like two steps forward, one steps back. And
Yeah,
that's
well,
it. Go ahead.
I think in some ways, college tennis has grown over the past decade, 15 years.
Yeah.
It's definitely regressed from where it was in its peak in like the 70s, 80s, and 90s.
Especially when
But
American tennis was on top, which should have been taken
yes,
advantage of in that sense.
exactly. And, Georgia folks can tell you all the stories in the world about that crowd size. And like, even, here at Stanford, like, there are significantly more people in the stands back in those decades. So I think what's challenging is even now, from a point of 10 years ago, it does feel like the sport is moving forward, but the pace or the curve at which it's moving forward pales in comparison to what you're seeing with other sports.
I agree. Especially with, I think the best comparison I can have is volleyball. The amount of women's volleyball coverage that there is right now, like it used to be on TV for the tournament, but now it's constantly on and people enjoy watching it. I feel like that's a sport that people have gotten around to be like, oh, it's on ESPN, let's watch. And there's, and even with, we've compared this before, I feel like, but Golf Channel and College Golf, like on with even during tournaments, it's not even individuals, it's like tournaments with college kids that are competing. They promote it because they're going to be the next people on the tour. So, where's the disconnect?
You know what's actually a very specific thing that is the most frustrating thing. I can give you
What?
a very specific
Please
answer.
do.
Tennis is one of the most played recreational sports in this country. There are tens of millions of people who play recreationally. How we have not been able to convert those people into attending local college matches will never make sense to me. And you look at these other sports that have seen significant growth. No adult is playing volleyball, but they're all going to those volleyball games and they're having fun and they're enjoying it. Everyone is building a community and playing tennis recreationally, and everyone, tens of millions of people are, but they're not going to these matches. That is the single thing that just keeps me up at night of how do we convert these tens of millions of people that are playing tennis, engaged in tennis, it's a part of their daily life or their weekly life, it's a community they have. Why are they not showing up to college tennis matches?
That's an excellent point. And one thing that I was told, I think my dad told me this once, when Connecticut Open 2019, my dad was able to get finals tickets the day of for $25. How, why don't tournaments, not only tournaments, but college programs go to local tennis clubs and just give like a local group or a club, hey, here's tickets, come watch us play. instead of handing out flyers. Like, you can do your own marketing and kind of incentivize them to come, because that way it just at least gets them to watch one, and then maybe one gets hooked, then they keep coming, and then two gets hooked, two come, and then it just builds from there. Why is there no like advancement in that to allow player to allow people to still come and watch these matches?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what I mean by the deeper connections with your community, right? There are tennis community clubs or communities in your area that you need to build a stronger relationship with. I think that's one of the advantages that TCU has. TCU has a ton of courts on campus. Not all those courts are their collegiate courts, and they have players there all day, every day, clubs, clinics, etc. Makes it so much easier for them to build a community around TCU tennis. Most of these college campuses aren't opening their courts to recreational players because they only have, six courts, and they're not going to risk that. The USTA has tried to incentivize schools to do that by opening them up and giving them grants to do that. I think it's a great idea. I think the more that you can bring that community to you, and if you can't bring them to your courts, go to their courts. To your point, say, hey, look, we're having a match. And by the way, whoever brings the most kids gets a free clinic for from one of our coaches or something like that.
It's just all about the small stuff that can grow it, and a lot of people do that. At least the college coaches that I've talked to, some of them are doing that very successfully and building that community around the area that their matches happen. And I agree with you. That is a very neat, not a niche, but a very specific frustration that I can understand and get behind.
Yeah.
It's how long have you been thinking about that?
I think about it every time I see the number showcased by the USTA, right? Of like how many players are competing recreationally. It's like none of these other sports that see this growth have these types of players engaging in this sport recreationally. And they're not coming out to matches. And I also have that thought when I go to the USTA NCAAs, because in that case, you have hundreds, if not thousands, of people walking through those doors every day playing on those courts. And yeah, I'm just have to like, can we just divert a few of them over to the matches? Like, come on, just like, oh, after you hit, come over and watch. Like, so yeah, I think about it a lot.
That is a frustration I would have as well. And John, I can't thank you enough for joining us again. It's a lot of fun having you on to talk about college tennis and to preview this upcoming season. And I like how we go on tangents too. It makes it fun. It makes it a lot of fun. I appreciate you coming on, John.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me. Thanks for continuing to promote college tennis.